performance and what can be done to improve it? Have those who developed the approach identified the best performers in that particular area and determined what sets them apart from everyone else? Is the practice designed to develop the particular skills that experts in the field possess? A yes answer to all those questions may not guarantee that an approach will be effective, but it will certainly make that much more likely. The Top Gun Approach to Learning. One of the major challenges facing anyone trying to apply the principles of deliberate practice is figuring out exactly what the best performers do that sets them apart. What are, in the words of one very successful book, the habits of highly effective people? In the business world and elsewhere, this is a difficult question to answer with any certainty. Fortunately, there's a way around this that can be used in a variety of situations. Think of it as the Top Gun approach to improvement. In the early days of the Top Gun project, no one stopped to try to figure out what made the best pilots so good. They just set up a program that mimicked the situations pilots would face in real dogfights, and that allowed the pilots to practice their skills over and over again with plenty of feedback and without the usual costs of failure. That is a pretty good recipe for training programs in many different disciplines. Consider the task of interpreting X-rays to detect breast cancer. When a woman gets her annual mammogram, the images are sent to a radiologist, who must examine them and determine if there are any abnormal areas of the breast that need to be tested further. In most cases, the women coming in for the mammograms have no symptoms indicating the presence of breast cancer, so the X-ray images are all the radiologist has to go on. And research has found that just as with the Navy pilots during the early stages of the Vietnam War, some radiologists are able to perform this job much better than others. Tests have shown, for example, that some radiologists are much more accurate than others in distinguishing between benign and malignant lesions. The main problem that radiologists face in this situation is the difficulty in getting effective feedback on their diagnoses, which limits how much they can improve over time. Part of the challenge is that only 4 to 8 cases of cancer are expected to be found among every 1,000 mammograms. And even when the radiologist detects what may be cancer, the results are sent back to the patient's personal doctor, and the radiologist will seldom be notified about the biopsy's results. It is even less common for the radiologist to be informed whether the patient develops breast cancer within the next year or so after the mammogram, which would give the radiologist a chance to re-examine the mammograms and see whether he or she might have missed the early signs of cancer. With little chance for the type of feedback-driven practice that leads to improvement, radiologists do not necessarily get better with more experience. A 2004 analysis of 500,000 mammograms and 124 American radiologists was not able to identify any background factors of the radiologists, such as years of experience or the number of yearly diagnosed mammograms, that were related to accuracy of diagnosis. The authors of that study speculated that the differences in performance among the 124 radiologists might be due to the initial training the doctors received before starting independent practice. After completing medical school and their internships, future radiologists have a 4-year specialty training program in which they learn their craft by working with experienced radiologists who teach them what to look for and allow them to read mammograms of patients. These supervisors check their readings, telling them whether their diagnoses and identification of abnormal areas agreed with the supervisor's own expert opinion. Of course, there is no way to know immediately whether the supervisor was right or wrong, and even experienced radiologists are estimated to miss 1 cancer per every 1,000 readings and to regularly request unnecessary biopsies. In the published version of my keynote at the 2003 annual meeting of the American Association of Medical Colleges, I suggested a Top Gun-like approach to training radiologists to interpret mammograms more effectively. The main problem, as I saw it, was that radiologists do not have the chance to practice their readings over and over again, getting accurate feedback with each attempt. So this is what I suggested. You'd start by collecting a library of digitized mammograms taken from patients years ago along with enough information from those patients' records to know the ultimate outcome, whether there actually was a cancerous lesion present, and if so, how the cancer progressed over time. In this way, we would collect, in essence, a number of test questions in which the answer is known. Is cancer present or not? Some of the images would be from women who never did develop cancer, while others would be from women whose doctors correctly diagnosed cancer from the image. It would even be possible to include images in which cancer was present but the doctor missed it originally, as long as a retrospective analysis of the image discovered signs of the cancer's presence. Ideally, the images would be chosen for their training value. There would be little value, for instance, in having lots of images of clearly healthy breasts or breasts with obvious tumors. The best images would be those that would challenge the radiologists by displaying cancerous or benign abnormalities. Once such a library was accumulated, it could easily be turned into a training tool. A simple computer program could be written to let radiologists work through the images, making diagnoses and getting feedback. The program could respond to a wrong answer by displaying other images with similar characteristics so that the doctor could get more practice on his or her weaknesses. This is no different in theory than a music teacher noticing that a student is having difficulty with a particular type of finger movement and assigning a series of exercises designed to improve that movement. It would be, in short, deliberate practice. I am delighted to report that a digital library very similar to what I proposed has been built in Australia. It allows radiologists to test themselves with a variety of mammograms they can retrieve from the library. A 2015 study reported that performance on a test set of mammograms from the library predicted how accurately radiologists interpreted mammograms in their professional practice. The next step will be to demonstrate that improvements from training with the library lead to increased accuracy in the clinic. A similar library has been independently assembled for pediatric ankle X-rays. As reported in a 2011 study, a group of doctors at Morgan Stanley Children's Hospital in New York City assembled a set of 234 cases of possible ankle injury in a child. Each case included a series of X-rays and a brief summary of the patient's history and symptoms. The doctors used this library to train radiology residents. A resident would be given the case details and the X-rays and asked to make a diagnosis, in particular to classify the case as normal or abnormal, and if it was abnormal, to point out the abnormality. Immediately afterward, the resident would get feedback on the diagnosis from an experienced radiologist, who would explain what was right and wrong about the diagnosis and what was missed. The doctors running the study found that this practice and feedback helped the residents improve their diagnostic powers dramatically. At first, the residents were relying on their own previous knowledge, and their diagnoses were hit or miss. But after 20 or so trials, the effects of the regular feedback started to kick in, and the residents' accuracy began to increase steadily. The improvement continued through all 234 cases, and from all appearances would have continued through at least several hundred more if they'd been available. In short, this sort of training with immediate feedback, either from a mentor or even a carefully designed computer program, can be an incredibly powerful way to improve performance. Furthermore, I believe that radiology training could be even more effective if an effort were made up front to determine what sorts of issues are likely to cause problems for new radiologists and design the training to focus more on those issues. In essence, to learn more about the role that mental representations play in making accurate diagnoses and apply that understanding in designing the training. Some researchers have used the same sort of think-aloud protocol I used in studying Steve Falloon in order to understand the mental processes underlying superior performance among radiologists, and it seems clear from this work that the best radiologists have indeed developed more accurate mental representations. We even have a good idea of the types of cases and lesions that give trouble to the less expert radiologists. Unfortunately, we do not yet know enough about the differences between how expert and non-expert radiologists make their judgments to design training programs to address the weaknesses of the less accomplished ones. However, we can see exactly how this sort of training might work in the case of laparoscopic surgery, for which researchers have done much more work in assembling an understanding of the types of mental representations that effective doctors use in their work. In one study, a group led by Lawrence Wei, a surgeon at the University of California, San Francisco, set out to understand what led to a particular type of injury to patients' bile ducts during laparoscopic surgery to remove their gallbladders. In almost every case, these injuries were due to what the group called a visual perception illusion. That is, the surgeon mistook one body part for another. This led the surgeon to cut a bile duct instead of, say, a cystic duct, which was the intended target. The misperception was so strong that even when a surgeon noticed an anomaly, he would often keep going without stopping to question whether something might be wrong. Other researchers studying factors in the success of laparoscopic surgery have found that expert surgeons develop ways of getting a clearer look at the body parts, such as pushing some tissues aside in order to produce a better view for the camera that is used to guide the procedure. This is exactly the sort of information that makes it possible to improve performance through designed practice. Knowing what the best laparoscopic surgeons do right, and knowing the most common mistakes, it should be possible to design training exercise outside the operating room to improve surgeons' mental representations. One way would be to use videos of actual surgeries, run them up to a certain decision point, then stop them, and ask, "What do you do next?" or "What are you looking at here?" The answer might be a line on the video screen showing where to cut, or drawing the outline of a bile duct, or a suggestion to push aside a bit of tissue to get a better look. The surgeons could get immediate feedback on their answers, going back to correct erroneous thinking and moving on to other, perhaps tougher challenges when they do it right. Using such an approach, doctors could carry out dozens or hundreds of training runs, focusing on various aspects of the surgery that are known to cause problems, until they develop effective mental representations. More generally, this Top Gun approach could be applied in a wide variety of areas in which people could benefit from practicing something over and over again, offline, that is, away from their real job, where mistakes have real consequences. This is the rationale behind using simulators to train pilots, surgeons, and many others in high-stakes professions. Indeed, using libraries of mammograms to train radiologists is a kind of simulation. But there are many more areas where this concept could be put to use. One could imagine, for instance, creating a library of case studies designed to help tax accountants hone their skills in certain specialties, or to help intelligence analysts improve their abilities to interpret what is happening in a foreign country. Even in those areas where simulators or other techniques are already being used to improve performance, their effectiveness could be greatly increased by explicitly taking into account the lessons of deliberate practice. As I mentioned, while simulators are used in a number of areas of surgery, they could probably improve performance much more effectively if their design took into account what is known or what can be learned about the mental representations of the most effective surgeons in a given specialty. It is also possible to improve simulator training by determining which errors are most common and most dangerous, and by setting up the simulators to focus on the situations where those errors happen. For example, during surgery, it is not uncommon that some interruption brings the procedure to a temporary halt. And if the interruption occurs while someone is starting to check the blood type prior to a blood transfusion, it is critical that the person continue this checking when the activity resumes after the interruption. To help surgeons and other members of the medical team gain experience in dealing with such interruptions, a simulator supervisor can initiate an interruption at exactly the critical point on various occasions. The possibilities for such sorts of simulator practice are endless. Knowledge versus skills. One of the implicit themes of the Top Gun approach to training, whether it is for shooting down enemy planes or interpreting mammograms, is the emphasis on doing. The bottom line is what you are able to do, not what you know, although it is understood that you need to know certain things in order to be able to do your job. This distinction between knowledge and skills lies at the heart of the difference between traditional paths toward expertise and the deliberate practice approach. Traditionally, the focus is nearly always on knowledge. Even when the ultimate outcome is being able to do something, solve a particular type of math problem, say, or write a good essay, the traditional approach has been to provide information about the right way to proceed, and then mostly rely on the student to apply that knowledge. Deliberate practice, by contrast, focuses solely on performance and how to improve it. When Dario Donatelli, the third person to take part in my memory experiment at Carnegie Mellon, began trying to improve his digit memory, he spoke with Steve Falloon, who told him exactly what he had done to get up to 82 digits. Indeed, Dario and Steve were friends and saw each other regularly, so Steve often gave Dario ideas and instruction about how to create mnemonics for groups of digits and how to organize those groups in his memory. In short, Dario had a tremendous amount of knowledge about how to memorize digits, but he still had to develop the skill. Because Dario didn't have to rely on the same trial and error that Steve did, he was able to improve more quickly, at least in the beginning. But it was still a long, slow process to develop his memory. The knowledge helped, but only to the extent that Dario had a better idea of how to practice in order to develop the skill. When you look at how people are trained in the professional and business worlds, you find a tendency to focus on knowledge at the expense of skills. The main reasons are tradition and convenience. It is much easier to present knowledge to a large group of people than it is to set up conditions under which individuals can develop skills through practice. Consider medical training. By the time future doctors have graduated from college, they have spent more than a decade and a half being educated. But almost all of that education will have focused on providing knowledge, little or none of which will have direct application to the skills they will need as doctors. Indeed, future doctors don't begin their training in medicine until they enter medical school. And even once they reach that milestone, they spend a couple of years in coursework before getting to clinical work, where they finally start developing their medical skills. It is mainly once they graduate from medical school that they begin specializing and developing the necessary skills for surgery or pediatrics or radiology or gastroenterology or whatever specialty they choose. Only at this point, when they're interns and residents working under the supervision of experienced doctors, do they finally learn many of the diagnostic and technical skills that they need for their specialties. After their internships and residencies, some doctors get a fellowship to continue on with even more specialized training. But that is the end of their official supervised training. Once new doctors have reached this stage, they go to work as full-fledged physicians with the assumption that they've developed all the skills they need to treat patients effectively. If this all sounds vaguely familiar, it should, for it is very similar to the pattern I described in Chapter 1, when explaining how one might learn to play tennis. Take some tennis lessons, develop enough skill to play the game competently, and then set aside the intense training that characterized the original learning period. As I noted, most people assume that as you continue to play tennis and accumulate all of those hours of practice, you will inevitably get better. But the reality is different. As we've seen, people generally don't get much better just by playing the game itself, and sometimes they'll actually be worse. This similarity between doctors and recreational tennis players was shown in 2005, when a group of researchers at Harvard Medical School published an extensive review of research looking at how the quality of care that doctors provide changes over time. If years of practice make physicians better, then the quality of care they give should increase as they amass more experience. But just the opposite was true. In almost every one of the 5 dozen studies included in the review, doctors' performance grew worse over time, or at best, stayed about the same. The older doctors knew less and did worse in terms of providing appropriate care than doctors with far fewer years of experience, and researchers concluded that it was likely the older doctors' patients fared worse because of it. Only 2 of 62 studies had found doctors to have gotten better with experience. Another study of decision-making accuracy in more than 10,000 clinicians found that additional professional experience had only a very small benefit. Not surprisingly, the same thing is true for nurses as well. Careful studies have shown that very experienced nurses do not, on average, provide any better care than nurses who are only a few years out of nursing school. We can only speculate as to why the performance of older and more experienced healthcare providers is not consistently better and is sometimes worse than that of their younger, less experienced peers. Certainly, the younger doctors and nurses will have received more up-to-date knowledge and training in school, and if continuing education doesn't keep doctors effectively updated, then the older they get, the less current their skill will be. But one thing is clear. With few exceptions, neither doctors nor nurses gain expertise from experience alone. Of course, doctors do work very hard to improve. They're constantly attending conferences, meetings, workshops, mini-courses, and the like, where the goal is updating them on the latest thinking and techniques in their fields. As I was writing this, I visited the website of doctorsreview.com, which bills itself as the most complete medical meetings listings on the web. On the meetings search page, I picked a field at random, cardiology, and a month at random, August 2015, and then hit a button to request a list of all the meetings on that topic during that month. It gave me 21, ranging from the Cardiovascular Fellows Boot Camp in Houston to ultrasound-guided vascular access in St. Petersburg, Florida, and electrophysiology. Arrhythmias Unraveled for Primary Care Providers and Cardiologists in Sacramento, California. And that was just 1 month for one specialty. The site promised more than 2,500 meetings in all. In short, doctors are clearly serious about keeping their skills sharp. Unfortunately, the way they have been doing it just isn't working. Several researchers have examined the benefits of continuing medical education for practicing physicians, and the consensus is that while it is not exactly worthless, it's not doing much good either. But to the credit of the medical profession, I have found doctors to be exceptionally willing to look for shortcomings in their fields and search for ways to correct them. It is largely because of this willingness that I've spent so much time working with doctors and other medical professionals. It is not because medical training is less effective than training in other fields, but rather because those in this field are so motivated to find ways to improve. Some of the most compelling research on the effectiveness of continuing professional education for physicians has been done by Dave Davis, a doctor and educational scientist at the University of Toronto. In a very influential study, Davis and a group of colleagues examined a wide-ranging group of educational interventions, by which they meant courses, conferences, and other meetings, lectures, and symposia, taking part in medical rounds, and pretty much anything else whose goal was to increase doctors' knowledge and improve their performance. The most effective interventions, Davis found, were those that had some interactive component, role play, discussion groups, case solving, hands-on training, and the like. Such activities usually did improve both the doctor's performance and their patient's outcomes, although the overall improvement was small. By contrast, the least effective activities were didactic interventions. That is, those educational activities which essentially consisted of doctors listening to a lecture, which, sadly enough, are by far the most common types of activities in continuing medical education. Davis concluded that this sort of passive listening to lectures had no significant effect at all on either doctors' performance or on how well their patients fared. That study reviewed other studies of continuing medical education that had been published before 1999. A decade later, a group of researchers led by Norwegian researcher Louisa Forsetlund updated Davis's work, looking at 49 new studies of continuing medical education that had been published in the meantime. That group's conclusions were similar to Davis's. Continuing medical education can improve doctors' performance, but the effect is small, and the effects on patient outcomes are even smaller. In addition, it is mainly those education approaches with some interactive component that have an effect. Lectures, seminars, and the like do little or nothing to help doctors improve their practice. Finally, the researchers found that no type of continuing medical education is effective at improving complex behaviors. That is, behaviors that involve a number of steps or require considering a number of different factors. In other words, to the extent that continuing medical education is effective in changing only the most basic things that doctors do in their practices. From the perspective of deliberate practice, the problem is obvious. Attending lectures, mini-courses, and the like offers little or no feedback and little or no chance to try something new, make mistakes, correct the mistakes, and gradually develop a new skill. It's as if amateur tennis players try to improve by reading articles in tennis magazines and watching the occasional YouTube video. They may believe they're learning something, but it's not going to help their tennis game much. Furthermore, in the online interactive approaches to continuing medical education, it is very difficult to mimic the sorts of complex situations that doctors and nurses encounter in their everyday clinical practice. Once they've finished their training, medical and other professionals are supposed to be able to work independently. They have no one assigned to them to play the role of the tennis pro, working with them to identify their weaknesses, coming up with training regimens to fix them, and then overseeing and even leading that training. More generally, the field of medicine, as is the case with most other professional fields, lacks a strong tradition of supporting the training and further improvement of practicing professionals. It is assumed that medical professionals are able to figure out, on their own, effective practice techniques and apply them to improve their performance. In short, the implicit assumption in medical training has been that if you provide doctors with the necessary knowledge, in medical school, through medical journals, or through seminars and continuing medical education classes, this should be sufficient. There is a saying in medicine about learning surgical procedures that can be traced back to William Halsted, a surgical pioneer in the early 20th century. See one, do one, teach one. The idea is that all surgical trainees need in order to be able to carry out a new surgery is to see it done once, and after that, they can figure out how to do it by themselves on succeeding patients. It is the ultimate profession of faith in knowledge versus skill. However, this faith was severely challenged in the 1980s and 1990s with the spread of laparoscopic surgery, or keyhole surgery, in which a surgery is performed with instruments inserted through a small opening in the body that may be well away from the surgical site. It required techniques that were radically different from those of traditional surgery. Yet the general assumption was that experienced surgeons should be able to pick up this new technique relatively quickly without extra training. After all, they had all the necessary knowledge to carry out the procedures. However, when medical researchers compared the learning curves of surgeons who had a great deal of experience in traditional surgery with the learning curves of surgical trainees, they found no difference in how quickly the two groups mastered laparoscopic surgery and reduced the numbers of complications. In short, neither their greater knowledge nor their greater experience in traditional surgery gave the experienced surgeons an advantage in developing skill in laparoscopic surgery. That skill, it turns out, must be developed independently. Because of these findings, surgeons today who wish to perform laparoscopic procedures must go through training supervised by expert laparoscopic surgeons and be tested on this specific skill. It is not just the medical profession that has traditionally emphasized knowledge over skills in its education. The situation is similar in many other professional schools, such as law schools and business schools. In general, professional schools focus on knowledge rather than skills because it is much easier to teach knowledge and then create tests for it. The general argument has been that the skills can be mastered relatively easily if the knowledge is there. One result is that when college students enter the work world, they often find that they need a lot of time to develop the skills they need to do their job. Another result is that many professions do no better a job than medicine, and in most cases a worse job, of helping practitioners sharpen their skills. Again, the assumption is that simply accumulating more experience will lead to better performance. As is the case in so many situations, once you have figured out the right question to ask, you are halfway to the right answer. And when referring to improving performance in a professional or business setting, the right question is, how do we improve the relevant skills? Rather than, how do we teach the relevant knowledge? A new approach to training. As we've seen with the Top Gun approach and Art Turok's work, there are ways to immediately apply the principles of deliberate practice to improve skills in professional and business settings. But over the long term, I believe the best approach will be to develop new skills-based training programs that will supplement or completely replace the knowledge-based approaches that are the norm now in many places. This strategy acknowledges that because what is ultimately most important is what people are able to do, training should focus on doing rather than on knowing, and in particular on bringing everyone's skills closer to the level of the best performers in a given area. Since 2003, I've been working with medical professionals to show how deliberate practice could sharpen the skills that doctors rely on every day. Switching over to such methods would represent a paradigm shift and would have far-reaching benefits to doctors' abilities and, ultimately, to the health of their patients. In one very relevant study, John Birkmeyer and colleagues invited a group of bariatric surgeons in Michigan to submit videotapes of typical examples of laparoscopic gastric bypasses from their clinics. The researchers then had the tapes evaluated anonymously by experts to assess the technical skills of the surgeons. For our purposes, the key finding was that there were large differences in patient outcomes among surgeons of differently rated technical skills, with patients of the more technically adept surgeons being less likely to experience complications or mortality. This suggests that patients could benefit greatly if less technically skilled surgeons could be helped to improve their skills. The results led to the creation of a project in which highly skilled surgeons coach less technically skilled surgeons to help them improve. In the rest of this chapter, I'll sketch out how the principles of deliberate practice could be applied to develop new and more effective training methods for doctors that should ultimately result in better outcomes for patients. The first step is to determine, with some certainty, who the expert doctors are in a given area. How can we identify those doctors whose performance is reliably superior to other doctors? This is not always easy, as we discussed in Chapter 4, but there are generally ways to do it with reasonable objectivity. Because the bottom line in medicine is the health of the patient, what we really want to find is some patient outcome that can be definitively linked to the behavior of a doctor. This can be tricky because medical care is a complicated process involving many steps and many people, and there are relatively few outcome measures that can be clearly linked to the contributions of an individual caregiver. Nonetheless, there are at least two good examples that illustrate in general how we might identify expert doctors. In 2007, a group of researchers led by Andrew Vickers of the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City reported the outcomes for nearly 8,000 men with prostate cancer who had had their prostates surgically removed. The procedures had been done by 72 different surgeons at four medical centers between 1987 and 2003. The goal of such surgeries is to remove the entire prostate gland, along with any cancer in the surrounding tissue. This complex operation requires painstaking care and skill, and if it is not done exactly right, cancer is more likely to recur. Thus, the success rate in preventing a recurrence of cancer after this operation should offer an objective measure that can separate the best surgeons from the rest. And this is what Vickers and his colleagues found. There was a major difference in skill between surgeons who had had a great deal of experience with this surgery and those who had relatively few such operations under their belts. While surgeons who had performed just 10 prostatectomies had a 5-year cancer recurrence rate of 17.9%, those who had performed 250 prior surgeries had a recurrence rate of just 10.7%. In other words, you were almost twice as likely to have your cancer come back within 5 years if you were operated on by an inexperienced surgeon than if you were operated on by an experienced one. In a follow-up study, Vickers examined what happened to recurrence rates as surgeons got even more experience, and he found that the rates continued to drop up until the point where a surgeon had carried out 1,500 to 2,000 surgeries. At that point, the surgeons had become essentially perfect at preventing 5-year recurrence in the simpler cases where the cancer had not spread outside the prostate. While they were preventing recurrence in 70% of the more complex cases where the cancer had spread outside the prostate. After that, the success rate did not improve with more practice. In the paper describing the results, Vickers noted that his group had not had the chance to figure out just what the highly experienced surgeons were doing differently. It seemed clear, however, that performing hundreds or thousands of the surgeries had led the doctors to develop particular skills that made a huge difference to their patients' outcomes. It is also worth noting that because increasing experience in the surgery led to increasing competence, there must have been some sort of feedback available to the surgeons that allowed them to improve over time by correcting and sharpening their techniques. Surgery is different from most other areas of medicine in that many problems are immediately apparent, such as a rupture of a blood vessel or damage to tissue, and thus surgeons get immediate feedback about at least some of their mistakes. In the post-operative surgery suite, the patient's condition is monitored carefully. Occasionally, at this stage, there is bleeding or some other problem, and the patient must undergo surgery to correct the problem. Such corrective surgeries also give surgeons feedback about potentially avoidable problems. In the case of surgeries to remove cancerous lesions, laboratory analysis of the removed cancer tissue permits an analysis of whether all of the cancer was successfully removed. Ideally, all of the removed tissue should have some healthy tissue surrounding the cancer. And if the surgeon failed to provide these clean margins, this provides yet another type of feedback he or she can use when carrying out similar operations in the future. In heart surgery, it is possible to test the repaired heart to assess the success of the surgery and to determine, if the surgery was not successful, what went wrong. Feedback like this is most likely the reason that surgeons, unlike most other medical professionals, get better as they gain experience. Deliberate, practice-based techniques to build surgical skills could be particularly valuable because it is clear from this study and others like it that surgeons need years and many surgeries to reach a point at which they can be considered experts. If training programs could be developed that halved the time a surgeon needs to reach expert status, it could make a major difference to patients. A pattern of improvement similar to what Vickers observed in surgeons was seen in a study of radiologists interpreting mammograms. The radiologists improved considerably in their interpretations over the first 3 years they spent on the job, coming up with fewer and fewer false positives. That is, cases in which women did not have breast cancer but were called in for further screening. And then their rate of improvement slowed down sharply. Interestingly, this improvement over the first 3 years occurred only for radiologists who had not had fellowship training in radiology. Those doctors who had gone through a radiology fellowship did not have the same sort of learning curve, but instead took only a few months on the job to reach the same skill level that the non-fellowship radiologists took 3 years to develop. If the training received in fellowships helps radiologists reach expert status that much more quickly than they normally would, it seems reasonable to assume that a well-designed training program that didn't require a fellowship might be able to accomplish the same thing. Once you have identified people who consistently perform better than their peers, The next step is to figure out what underlies that superior performance. This usually involves some variation of the approach described in Chapter 1 that I used in the memory work with Steve Falloon. That is, you get retrospective reports, you have people describe what they're thinking about as they perform a task, and you observe which tasks are easier or harder for someone and draw conclusions from that. The researchers who have studied doctors' thought processes in order to understand what separates the best from the rest have used all of these techniques. A good example of this approach is a recent study of 8 surgeons who were quizzed about their thought processes before, during, and after they performed laparoscopic surgeries. These surgeries, which are carried out with a small incision through which the surgical instruments are inserted and then guided to the surgical target, require a great amount of preparation and the ability to adapt to whatever conditions are discovered once the surgery begins. A major aim of the study was to identify the sorts of decisions the surgeons made throughout the process and to figure out how they made those decisions. The researchers listed several types of decisions that the surgeons had to make during surgery, such as which tissues to cut, whether to switch from laparoscopy to open surgery, and if they needed to drop their original surgical plan and improvise. The details are mostly interesting only to laparoscopic surgeons and those who teach them, but one finding has much broader relevance. Relatively few of the surgeries were simple and straightforward enough to be carried out by following the basic pattern one expects for such surgeries. To the contrary, most of them took some unexpected turn or threw up some unexpected obstacle that forced the surgeon to think carefully about what he or she was doing and make some sort of decision. As the researchers who performed the study put it, even expert surgeons find themselves in situations in which they must thoughtfully reevaluate their approach during surgery, evaluating alternative actions, such as the selection of different instruments or changing the position of the patient. This ability to recognize unexpected situations, quickly consider various possible responses, and decide on the best one is important not just in medicine, but in many areas. For instance, the U.S. Army has spent a considerable amount of time and effort figuring out the best way to teach what it calls adaptive thinking to its officers, particularly the lieutenants, captains, majors, and colonels who are on the ground with the troops and may have to immediately determine the best actions in response to an unexpected attack or other unforeseen event. It has even developed the Think Like a Commander training program to teach this sort of adaptive thinking to its junior officers using deliberate practice techniques. Research into the mental processes of the best doctors has shown that while they may have prepared surgical plans before they start, they regularly monitor the surgeries in progress and are ready to switch gears if necessary. This was apparent from a series of recent studies done by medical researchers in Canada, who observed operations that the surgeons had predicted would be challenging. When the researchers interviewed the surgeons after the operations about their thought processes during the surgery, they found that the main way the surgeons detected problems was by noticing that something about the surgery didn't match the way they had visualized the surgery in their preoperative plan. Once they noticed the mismatch, they came up with a list of alternative approaches and decided which was most likely to work. This points to something important about how these experienced surgeons perform. Over time, they have developed effective mental representations that they use in planning the surgery, in performing it, and in monitoring its progress so that they can detect when something is wrong and adapt accordingly. Ultimately, then, if we are going to understand what makes a superior surgeon, we need to have a good idea of what a superior surgeon's mental representations look like. Psychologists have developed various ways to study mental representations. One standard approach for examining the mental representations that people use to guide themselves through a task is to stop them in the middle of the task, turn out the lights, and then ask them to describe the current situation, what has happened, and what is about to happen. We saw an example of this method in the research on soccer players described in Chapter 3. This obviously won't work for surgeons in an operating room, But there are other ways to investigate the mental representations of people in potentially risky situations like surgery. In cases where simulators are available, flight training, for instance, or certain types of medical procedures, it is actually possible to stop in the middle and quiz people. Or in the case of real surgeries, the doctors can be questioned before and after the operations about how they envision the surgery going and about their thought processes during the surgery. In this case, it's best to combine the interviews with observations of the surgeon's actions during the surgery. Ideally, you would like to identify characteristics of mental representations that are associated with greater success in the surgeries. It has been primarily since the beginning of the 21st century that a few researchers have been successful in identifying those practicing doctors with reliably superior performance and have begun to investigate their mental processes. It's already clear, however, that a major factor underlying the abilities of the world's best doctors is the quality of their mental representations. This implies that a major part of applying the lessons of deliberate practice to medicine will be finding ways to help doctors develop better mental representations through training, a situation that holds in most other professions as well. Chapter 6. Principles of Deliberate Practice in Everyday Life. In 2010, I got an email from a man named Dan McLaughlin in Portland, Oregon. He had read about my deliberate practice research in various places, including Jeff Colvin's book, Talent is Overrated, and he wanted to use it in his efforts to become a professional golfer. To understand just how audacious this was, you need to know a little about Dan. He had not played on his high school or college golf team. In fact, he'd never really played golf at all. He'd been to a driving range with friends a few times, but he'd never played a full 18-hole round of golf in his life. Indeed, at 30 years old, he had never been a competitive athlete of any sort. But he had a plan, and he was serious about it. He would quit his job as a commercial photographer and spend the next 6 or so years learning to play golf. Having read Malcolm Gladwell's book Outliers and taken the 10,000-hour rule at face value, Dan figured he would put in 10,000 hours of deliberate practice and become a good enough player to join the Professional Golfers Association Tour. To get on the tour, he'd first have to gain admission to the PGA Tour qualifying tournament, and then do well enough in that tournament to receive a PGA Tour card. That would allow him to compete in PGA tournaments. A year and a half after starting his project, which he called the Dan Plan, he gave an interview to Golf Magazine. When the writer asked him why he was doing it, Dan gave an answer I really liked. He said he didn't appreciate the attitude that only certain people can succeed in certain areas, that only those people who are logical and good at math can go into mathematics, that only athletic people can go into sports, that only musically gifted people can become really good at playing an instrument. This sort of thinking just gave people an excuse not to pursue things that they might otherwise really enjoy and perhaps even be good at, and he didn't want to fall into that trap. "That inspired me to try something completely different from anything I'd ever done," he said. "I wanted to prove that anything's possible if you're willing to put in the time." Even more than this statement, I liked Dan's realization that deliberate practice isn't just for kids who are beginning a life of training to become chess grandmasters or Olympic athletes or world-class musicians. Nor is it just for members of large organizations like the U.S. Navy that can afford to develop some high-intensity training program. Deliberate practice is for everyone who dreams. It's for anyone who wants to learn how to draw, to write computer code, to juggle, to play the saxophone, to pen the great American novel. It's for everyone who wants to improve their poker game, their softball skills, their salesmanship, their singing. It's for all those people who want to take control of their lives and create their own potential and not buy into the idea that this, right here, right now, is as good as it gets. This chapter is for them. First, find a good teacher. Another of my favorite correspondents is Per Holmleth. a Swedish man who started taking karate lessons when he was 69 years old. He set himself a goal of gaining a black belt by the time he was 80. Per wrote to me after he'd been training for about 3 years. He told me that he thought he was progressing too slowly, and he asked for some advice on how he could train more effectively. Although he had been physically active all of his life, this was his first experience with martial arts. He was training in karate 5 or 6 hours a week, and spending another 10 hours a week in other exercise, mainly jogging in the woods and going to the gym. What more could he do? When hearing about Per, some people's natural reaction might be, well, of course he's not progressing too quickly, he's 72 years old. But that wasn't it. No, he wasn't going to improve as quickly as a 24-year-old or even a 54-year-old, but there was no doubt that he could get better more quickly than he was doing. So I offered some advice, the same advice I would offer to that 24-year-old or that 54-year-old. Most karate training is done in a class with a number of students and a single instructor who demonstrates a movement, which the class imitates. Occasionally, the instructor might notice a particular student performing the movement incorrectly and offer a little one-on-one tutoring. But such feedback is rare. Per was taking just such a class. So I suggested he get some personal sessions with a coach who would give advice tailored to Per's performance. Given the expense of private instruction, people will often try to make do with group lessons or even YouTube videos or books. And those approaches will generally work to some degree. But no matter how many times you watch a demonstration in class or on YouTube, you are still going to miss or misunderstand some subtleties, and sometimes some things that are not so subtle. And you are not going to be able to figure out the best way to fix all of your weaknesses, even if you do spot them. More than anything else, this is a problem of mental representations. As we discussed in Chapter 3, one of the main purposes of deliberate practice is to develop a set of effective mental representations that can guide your performance, whether you are practicing a karate move, playing a piano sonata, or performing surgery. When you're practicing by yourself, you have to rely upon your own mental representations to monitor your performance and determine what you might be doing wrong. This is not impossible, but it is much more difficult and less efficient than having an experienced teacher watching you and providing feedback. It is particularly difficult early in the learning process, when your mental representations are still tentative and inaccurate. Once you have developed a foundation of solid representations, you work from those to build new and more effective representations on your own. Even the most motivated and intelligent student will advance more quickly under the tutelage of someone who knows the best order in which to learn things, who understands and can demonstrate the proper way to perform various skills, who can provide useful feedback, and who can devise practice activities designed to overcome particular weaknesses. Thus, one of the most important things you can do for your success is to find a good teacher and work with him or her. How do you find a good teacher? This process will likely entail some trial and error, but there are a few ways you can improve your chances of success. First, while a good teacher does not have to be one of the best in the world, he or she should be accomplished in the field. Generally speaking, teachers will only be able to guide you to that level that they or their previous students have attained. If you're a flat-out beginner, any reasonably skilled teacher will do. But once you've been training for a few years, you'll need a teacher who is more advanced. A good teacher should also have some skill and experience in teaching in that field. Many accomplished performers are terrible teachers because they have no idea how to teach. Just because they themselves can do it doesn't mean they can teach others how to do it. Ask about a teacher's experience, and if possible, investigate and even talk to the teacher's former or current students. How good are they? How much of their skill can be attributed to that particular teacher? Do they speak highly of the teacher? The best students to talk to are those who started working with a teacher when they were about the same level you are now, since their experience will be closest to what you yourself will get from a teacher. Ideally, you want to find students similar in age and relevant experience. A teacher might be great with children and adolescents, but have less experience with and understanding of how to help someone a few decades older. When looking into a teacher's reputation, keep in mind the shortcomings of subjective judgments. Online rating sites are particularly vulnerable to these shortcomings, as the ratings on these sites often reflect how personable teachers are, or how enjoyable it is to learn from them, rather than how effective they are. In reading reviews of an instructor, skip over the stuff about how much fun their lessons are and look for specific descriptions of progress the students have made and obstacles they have overcome. It's particularly important to query a prospective teacher about practice exercises. No matter how many sessions a week you have with an instructor, most of your effort will be spent practicing by yourself, doing exercises that your teacher has assigned. You want a teacher who will guide you as much as possible for these sessions, not only telling you what to practice on, but what particular aspects you should be paying attention to, what errors you have been making, and how to recognize good performance. Remember, one of the most important things a teacher can do is to help you develop your own mental representations so that you can monitor and correct your own performance. Dan McLaughlin of the Dan Plan offers a good, if extreme, example of how to use instructors to improve. Dan had read about deliberate practice and had absorbed many of its lessons, so from the beginning of his quest he understood the importance of personal instruction. Before he even began, he'd already recruited three instructors, a golf coach, a strength and conditioning coach, and a nutritionist. Dan's later experience illustrates one final lesson about instruction. You may need to change teachers as you yourself change. For several years, he improved with his original golf coach, but at some point he stopped getting better. He had absorbed everything this coach could teach him, and he was ready to find a coach at the next level. If you find yourself at a point where you are no longer improving quickly or at all, don't be afraid to look for a new instructor. The most important thing is to keep moving forward. Engagement. Returning to Pear's story, we can see another essential element of deliberate practice that benefits from the right sort of one-on-one instruction. Engagement. I suspected that his group karate lessons were failing to keep him fully focused and engaged. In group classes, with the instructor at the front and all of the students following en masse, it is far too easy to just go through the motions instead of actually practicing them with the specific goal of improving a particular aspect of one's performance. You do 10 kicks with your right leg, then 10 kicks with your left. You do 10 block and punch combinations to the right, then 10 to the left. You get into a zone, your mind starts to wander, and pretty soon all of the benefit of the practice dissipates. This goes back to the basic principle we talked about in the first chapter. The importance of engaging in purposeful practice instead of mindless repetition without any clear plan for getting better. If you want to improve in chess, you don't do it by playing chess. You do it with solitary study of grandmasters' games. If you want to improve in darts, you don't do it by going to the bar with your friends and letting the loser buy the next round. You do it by spending some time alone, working on reproducing your throwing motion exactly from one throw to the next. You improve your control by systematically varying the point on the dartboards that you aim at. If you want to get better at bowling, those Thursday nights with your bowling league team won't do much good. You'll want to spend some quality time on your own, ideally working on difficult pin configurations, in which being able to control exactly where the ball goes is essential. And so on. Remember, if your mind is wandering, or you're relaxed and just having fun, you probably won't improve. A little over a decade ago, a group of Swedish researchers studied two groups of people during and after a singing lesson. Half of the subjects were professional singers, and the other half were amateurs. All had been taking lessons for at least 6 months. The researchers measured the subjects in a variety of ways: an electrocardiogram, blood samples, visual observations of the singer's facial expressions, and so on. And after the lesson, they asked a number of questions that were designed to determine the singer's thought processes during the lesson. All of the singers, both amateur and professional, felt more relaxed and energized after the lesson than before. but only the amateurs reported feeling elated afterward. The singing lesson had made the amateurs, but not the professionals, happy. The reason for the difference lay in how the two groups had approached the lesson. For the amateurs, it was a time to express themselves, to sing away their cares, and to feel the pure joy of singing. For the professionals, the lesson was a time to concentrate on such things as vocal technique and breath control in an effort to improve their singing. There was focus, but no joy.